came out specifically like they do, you know, nowadays. But back then, if you knew what to look for, you knew he was gay.
Oh, in The Wizard of Oz, the Tin Man wanted a heart and the Lion wanted courage. What did the Straw Man want?
He wanted the Tin Man to notice.
It's hard now to imagine a world where casual sex was casual.
Then there were the Rambles, of course, in Central Park. 24 hours a day full of people actually having sex behind trees. Constantly.
I want to look at sex before AIDS and the development of sexual attitudes and sexual behavior.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Protesting Presbyterians put church and state on notice, a new bio book gets inside Hollywood's Center Square, and a new film documents the gay 70s sexual revolution. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community, for the week ending November 19, 2005. A renegade New York church and a Virginia pastor with the courage of his convictions took stands this week destined to make waves in the Presbyterian Church USA. Disregarding the denomination's 1997 edict excluding non-celibate gays and lesbians from the ministry, the Hudson River Presbytery approved Raymond Bagnolo for ordination. During his November 13th ordination ceremony at the South Presbyterian Church in Dobbs Ferry, Bagnolo affirmed his acceptance of the authority of Scripture, belief in one God and Creator, and intention to proclaim the Word and Sacrament. However, when asked about his allegiance to the Church's Constitution, Bagnolo made it a point to exclude the Presbyterians' fidelity in marriage, chastity, and singleness standard, saying that the requirement questions God's creation and contributes to anti-lesbi-gay violence. The Hudson River Presbytery is one of a handful to openly defy the 1997 Fidelity Chastity Rule, which will be debated again at the denomination's biennial General Assembly next year. But until then, Bagnolo's ordination is clearly illegal, and a complaint could be filed against his presbytery. Meanwhile, Bagnolo has been assigned to pastor the 139-member Palisades Presbyterian Church in Palisades, New York, where the local church board has already declared their intention to ignore the constitutional ban on lesbian and gay clergy. This is a happy and wonderful indication of what can happen when you don't give up, Bagnolo said, and when you wait and see what God has in store for you.
In Arlington, Virginia, the target of Clarendon Presbyterian Church pastor David Ensign's protest is not the church, but the state. Upon accepting a county human rights award on behalf of his congregation, Ensign announced their decision to stop performing traditional marriages because of the state's laws against same-gender marriages. What we're saying is that in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the laws that govern marriage are unjust and unequal, Ensign told the Washington Post. The pastor has already renounced the authority granted to him by the state to officiate at weddings. Henceforth, heterosexual couples will be offered a celebration of commitment at Ensign's church, and then must be legally married by a justice of the peace. While not a violation of Presbyterian Church USA rules, Ensign's action is expected to come up at the denominational assembly next year.
Antagonisms within the worldwide Anglican Communion over LGBT issues have reached a point where cracks are beginning to appear, even on the conservative side of the argument. A letter to Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams, published by a network of Global South churches, called for the nominal head of the communion to take a harder stand against the ordination of non-celibate gays and lesbians and the blessing of same-gender couples. It's purported to be endorsed by 17 of the church's 38 archbishops, but since the headlines broke, several primates have said they did not give permission for their names to be used. First among the dissenters was Bishop of Jerusalem and the Middle East, Clive Hanford. Hanford expressed his reservations about attending the meeting of mostly African and Asian bishops organized by Archbishop of Nigeria, Peter Akinola, but said he felt it was appropriate because it was taking place in his own province. He said in a press release that he left before the fate of the draft letter had been decided and found it most regrettable and in no way helpful to the church's mission that it was placed on a website while Williams was involved in the Church of England's General Synod and unable to respond. At the London meeting, Williams was calling on synod leaders and members to engage in some interactive pluralism. He challenged each individual to make contact with someone in another part of the world who they were likely to disagree with in an effort to ease the suspicion and hostility or lack of mutual respect among Anglicans. In response to the news of the Global South letter, Williams' office said, "If it is an attempt to foreclose the debate, it would seem to serve very little purpose indeed."
Two more young men have been added to the list of gays executed in Iran, and that list may be growing faster than the international community realizes. The International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, announced this week that it is investigating reports that 92 executions and death sentences have been handed down in just the last 4.5 months. An exiled LGBT rights group has claimed that over 4,000 have been executed by the Iranian government since 1979. IGLHRC and the Muslim LGBT organization Al-Fatiha are lobbying the UN and international human rights groups to take action.
There was both good news and bad news this week for Kansas juvenile sex offender Matthew Lamone. The state Supreme Court last month struck down the so-called Romeo and Juliet sentencing law that punished underage homosexual activity much more harshly than similar sexual misbehavior by heterosexuals. Lamone was serving a 17-year prison term for having consensual oral sex just after his 18th birthday with a boy who was less than 4 years younger. Under the same law, the maximum jail sentence for heterosexuals was 15 months. Lamone was released from prison in early November by a county judge following the Kansas Supreme Court ruling, but he was ordered to stay on his aunt and uncle's family farm, keep away from minors, stay sober, and receive counseling. State Attorney General Phil Klein announced this week that, after careful review and consideration, his office has decided not to appeal the Kansas High Court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, which had been an option. But later in the week, County Attorney David Miller filed a charge of unlawful voluntary sexual relations against Lamone, telling reporters that he's not seeking more jail time, but that he wants Lamone to be on formal parole for up to 5 years with the state's Department of Corrections. That couldn't happen unless he was recharged and went through the judicial process, he said. So Matthew Lamone's days in court apparently aren't over. Paul Cates of the American Civil Liberties Union, which represents Lamone, said what Miller is doing is wrong. "It seems like the prosecutor is trying to extend the supervision," Cates said. "This is for somebody who's served 4.5 years in prison for a consensual sex act."
There was alarming HIV/AIDS news in the U.S. this week about men who have sex with men. According to new statistics released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, gay and bisexual men, particularly men of color, continue to represent the country's largest number of new HIV diagnoses. Slightly more than half of those diagnosed between 2001 and 2004 were African Americans, more than 8 times higher than whites. Latinos accounted for 18% of all HIV diagnoses, more than 3 times higher than whites. Gay and bisexual men of all races continue to account for the largest number of diagnoses from 2001 to 2004, 44% of all HIV diagnoses, and 61% among diagnosed men. New York was, for the first time, among 33 states surveyed in the report, providing a more balanced view of the epidemic across the U.S. The data also reflect an 8% jump in diagnoses between 2003 and 2004 among all men who have sex with men, regardless of ethnicity. But CDC officials could only speculate as to why. According to Dr. Ronald Valdeseri, acting director of the CDC's National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention, riskier sexual behaviors, such as the use of crystal meth leading to multiple partners, may account for those higher numbers. But he said it may also reflect an increase in HIV testing among gay and bisexual men. HIV continues to exact a tremendous toll on men who have sex with men of all races, said Valdeseri, especially men who have sex with men of color. And, said the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Matt Foreman, the Bush administration's defunding, deprioritizing, and de-gaying HIV prevention programs has been nothing short of a disaster. We call upon Congress to act immediately to begin to address this tragedy.
And finally, in happier numerical news, figures released this week by Statistics Netherlands show that the number of same-gender couples there has increased in the past decade from about 39,000 to 53,000, and that Amsterdam is their most favored place to live. About 12% of the couples are legally married, and another 10% are in registered partnerships. Perhaps surprisingly, at least compared with other countries where they've been counted, male couples are a bit more prevalent than female couples. 29,000 cohabiting same-gender couples are gay men, and 24,000 are lesbian. About 9% of those couples have one or more children, with lesbian couples more likely to have a child. 18% of cohabiting lesbians are raising children, compared with just 1% of gay male couples. Despite the significant increase over the past 10 years, however, gay and lesbian pairs represent just over 1% of the total number of counted cohabiting couples in the Netherlands. The figures also show that most queer Dutch couples prefer big cities. Nearly 25% live in Amsterdam, The Hague, Utrecht, or Rotterdam. The most popular city was Amsterdam. About 13% of all Dutch gay and lesbian couples live there. But given the city's well-known reputation for a live-and-let-love environment, it didn't require a statistician to figure that out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 19th, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written this week by Lucia Chappell and Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
It was everything your mother feared, but it gave birth to a culture that created community. We'll preview a new documentary about gay sexual liberation in the 1970s later in the program.
Balls, in The Wizard of Oz, the Tin Man wanted a heart and the Lion wanted courage. What did the Straw Man want?
He wanted the Tin Man to notice him.
He's probably best known as the Central Hollywood Square and for his roles as the father in the musical Bye Bye Birdie and Uncle Arthur on the much-beloved TV series Bewitched. But there was a lot more to Paul Lynde than risque one-liners, as Curtis Crick discovered when he spoke with Steve Wilson and Joe Florensky, the authors of a new biography of the actor and comedian, appropriately entitled Center Square.
Steve, tell me about how you got interested in Paul Lynde and how you came to write this book.
Sure. Well, I had always kind of been aware of him, but I hadn't quite realized who he was. I knew Uncle Arthur from Bewitched and Templeton the Rat from Charlotte's Web and various other, you know, Hollywood Squares, Center Square, of course. And I realized that this guy, Paul Lynde, was this pretty amazing presence, and I got interested in him as a comedian. But when I started to look into his life on a more personal level, I realized that there were a lot of great stories about him that had never really been written about.
Joe?
He's always been someone I've sort of known about, and one day I was at the library and I thought, well, think of someone totally ridiculous that I could like start looking for information about, because I have a degree in pop culture, so I just always like people from TV and movies and stuff like that. And so I thought, well, let's see what I can find out about Paul Lynde, and kind of realized he actually had a far more interesting career than I ever imagined, and that just sort of escalated into a research project and then a website and then offers to be on like A&E Biography and then eventually the book, so just kind of snowballed.
Back in the early movies, Paul, who would you be most likely to see on top of Tony, the Wonder Horse?
Oh, my friend Fletka.
Did everybody know Paul Lynde was gay?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I think everybody, a lot of people in Hollywood did, but people in Middle America were a little unfamiliar with gay culture, and I think they wrote him off as a kind of crazy, kooky character actor, you know, kind of like a Liberace effect. They just figured it was all an act.
It's kind of hard to imagine the sex symbol status that Paul Lynde had that you describe in the book.
Yeah, exactly. I think that maybe in the same way that young girls are attracted to guys in boy bands, you know, maybe it was the same thing with him. You know, he was this very clean-cut, well-dressed, stylish man. And, you know, that's kind of like a much more comforting kind of crush to have when you're watching daytime television instead of somebody with smoldering good looks. And Paul was a handsome man, but just not in a very macho kind of threatening way.
Yeah, on my website, I hear from quite a few women who were like teenagers in the 70s who just had no clue that Paul was gay and just thought he was just the dreamiest, which is so bizarre to me. It was far more prevalent than I actually thought, and it is very strange.
The great writer George Bernard Shaw once wrote, "It's such a wonderful thing. What a crime to waste it on children. What is it?"
A whipping.
He was always very funny, as you say, on Hollywood Squares. But when I read the book, I was really surprised to learn what an unpleasant guy he could really be.
Oh, right. Well, somebody told us that, I think it was Frank DeCaro, the radio host, he had a good point that, you know, Paul was the kind of guy you'd want to, like, party with, but not really hang out with the next day. And, of course, even partying with him could have been nearly life-threatening, you know. I mean, that's when he really let loose on people.
Yeah, he was very unhappy about his career and sort of his lot in life. I think he expected bigger things out of his career. He really wanted to be a movie star, and that just never happened. So I think that all sort of played into his unhappiness.
One other thing, though, I think, though, you know, so there are all these great stories about him just telling off people when he got drunk. And as we started to look into all that, he definitely was, you know, could be incredibly obnoxious and mean. But I also think that there were a lot of fragile egos in Hollywood. And I think that's part of how that reputation also developed. I mean, you know, he was dishing it out, and a lot of people couldn't take it.
Did his drinking come from his inability to be more out?
I think there were a lot of bizarre factors in his life that fed into that. Both his parents died within a month of each other, more or less, and that was just a little bit after they found out his brother had died in the war. So there was all kinds of tragedy in his life and a pretty unhappy childhood. But yeah, I think that having to live in the closet all those years, as everybody else in Hollywood had to, was really tough on him.
If you had your choice, Paul, would you rather be kicked by a mule or by an ostrich? They both sound pretty good to me.
Joe, how does his being gay affect his status as a star in the 70s?
I see him as someone who, you know, never sort of like hid who he was. I mean, he didn't never came out specifically like they do, you know, nowadays. But back then, he was pretty much Paul Lynde, you know. If you knew what to look for, you knew he was gay, and he never really hid it. You know, he never pretended to be heterosexual or, you know, came up with the sham marriage like Rock Hudson did. So in that way, he was sort of, you know, ahead of his time because he didn't play into all the Hollywood games you'd have to keep a career.
He died at the age of 55. What do you think would have become of him if he hadn't died so young?
Towards the end, he was definitely in a career slump, and he was pretty tired of the whole game, you know, looking for work and all that stuff. And he talked about wanting to open up a restaurant in New York, but I don't think it would have lasted too long. I think he would have ultimately maybe tried to go back to theater.
I think maybe he would have had one of those, like, cameo comedy careers, playing the wacky sort of guest star. He had talked about going back to Broadway. I think he would have been great in some sort of 80s musical.
I think eventually he probably would have had some kind of career upswing again, because throughout the 90s, his voice appears in all kinds of cartoons like The Simpsons and SpongeBob SquarePants, and I think that he would have become kind of this cherished relic almost, who would have been embraced all over again.
Looking back on it all, do you see him as a gay icon?
I don't see him as a gay icon, as someone to kind of emulate, but I see him as an important historical gay icon, maybe, you know.
That's one of the reasons we wanted to write the book, because we think he's kind of this unacknowledged gay icon, because he was out there every day in Hollywood Squares doing his thing and really bringing gay culture to this mainstream audience. And we think that it helped pave the way for Queer for the Straight Guy and Ellen and Will and Grace, and maybe even to a small degree just helping acceptance of gay culture in general.
Some airlines now give you a thorough frisking before permitting you to board the plane.
Oh, that's the only reason I fly.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. The book is called Center Square, The Paul Lynde Story by Steve Wilson and Joe Florensky. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm Curtis Crick.
This Way Out listener, Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Dayton, Ohio, in honor of his mother, Mabel Simmons, has issued a donor matching challenge to supporters of this program. To continue doubling our pleasure, Dr. Simmons has extended the deadline to November 30th, 2005. Please visit our website, thiswayout.org, for holiday gift-giving ideas, a year-end tax break, and to see how your help to keep This Way Out on the air will still mean twice as much to us. We'd be very thankful. Between the Stonewall riots in 1969 and the first cases of AIDS, there was a dozen-year period of unparalleled gay liberation in major U.S. cities that included a sexual free-for-all among gay men. Sex was everywhere, in bars, bathhouses, parks, and piers. Gay Sex in the 70s, a new documentary that chronicles gay culture in New York City during this period, captures the stories of people who lived it and their fading memories of the sexual side of a sexual revolution. Bearing copious clips, This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with producer-director Joseph Lovett about his film, the 1970s, Sex and the City.
Well, I was afraid of the trucks. I don't know whether it was an urban legend story or not, but I'd heard about, you know, people getting stabbed and what have you in that. And I didn't like the idea of having sex in dark, smelly places where I couldn't see the person that I was with.
And then there were the rambles, of course, in Central Park. 24 hours a day full of people actually having sex behind trees, constantly.
You did not care about the broken down, the danger, the dirty, the smell, the raunchiness. You cared about meeting someone and having sex. It was cruise, meet, have sex in one of the spots inside the piers.
It's hard now to imagine a world where casual sex was casual, when fear of a lethal sexually transmitted disease was unknown, and when being homosexual was more about endless sex than the right to marry.
I'm Joe Lovett. My film is Gay Sex in the 70s. I did the film for a number of reasons. I thought it was really important to look at the 12 years between 1969, Stonewall, and 1981, the beginning of AIDS, to really look at that time because it was really the forming of a gay community. And I had spent so much time in AIDS work putting sex and AIDS together. I wanted to look at sex before AIDS and the development of sexual attitudes and sexual behavior and looked at where it came from. I mean, before 1969, gay people were separated not only from their own feelings, they were separated from one another and separated from the culture in which they lived. And after Stonewall, people came together. And it was a revolutionary period anyway, with all the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the women's movement. Life was changing fast, and individuals were getting together and changing the rules. And gay men and women started to do that as well. But what was very important was that before this, they were separated from one another. Arnie Kantrowitz in the film talks about not knowing another gay person except for one until he was 29 years old. And he and his other friend used to write to one another in code. It's hard to imagine from a 2005 perspective, but that's the way things were. And I think it was very, very important to go back and look at the beginnings of the formation of a gay community. But the film is not about gay politics as much as it is about sexuality. The film is about sex. I wanted to do a film about sex. I wanted to do a frank film discussing gay sexuality. And I think that what we've done is, I think we've demystified it.
New York was a constant cruising opportunity. So lunch in Central Park or in any restaurant, everything was laden with, you know, potentially the opportunity for a date.
The storytellers in the film are for the most part in their 50s and 60s. And Lovett's juxtaposition of photos, showing them at their physical and sexual peak, has an oddly powerful impact.
We showed the film a number of times to different people of different ages, and one group of younger people said that they felt very uncomfortable seeing older men. They didn't like looking at older men, which is why we brought in the pictures of them as younger men, which seemed to help a great deal. I mean, you do become sexually invisible at a certain age. It usually starts around 45. Gay or straight, you pretty much become sexually invisible. And it's an interesting time, and it's a real shock when you're not seen as sexually viable as you're walking down the street. And it's natural for younger people not to be interested in people who are their parents' age. I mean, that's natural. I love being in an audience with younger and older people together because younger people see the film in a totally different way than older people, as they should. And their standards are different. Their world is different. And it's fascinating to hear the transgenerational conversations. I had one 37-year-old say to me that he could never imagine sex without fear. He didn't know that you were able to think about sex without fear. And an older man in the same discussion said, "Thank you for doing this film. I had forgotten that we ever had sex without fear."
There was a lot of public sex back then. In the 70s, there was the piers over here on West Street. There are the trucks. You know, I live right across the street from both. They were even there in the day. And then all the people would do it in the streets here. It was incredible.
Literally, I have been walking down Madison Avenue on my way to my office before work, 8:30 in the morning, seen a man on the street, we go like that, change numbers, have sex in his office during lunch. I have turned the corner, Christopher Street smiled at somebody, he said, you got a minute, and we went upstairs. And everybody I know has those kind of stories from those days.
As a producer for ABC News in the 1970s, Joseph Lovett produced What Do You Say When Your Kid Says He's Gay? It was the first gay-positive news special on broadcast television. After a stint as a producer at 2020, Joe left the network in 1989 to form his own production company.
I've done a great deal of work on AIDS prevention on television, and I've been fortunate to have had a career that allowed me to do a lot of work on AIDS, on ABC in particular, and on PBS. That's been very important to me. But this film, I really wanted to be about sex. And I really wanted to separate AIDS and sex. And I really wanted to look at sex and explore the sexual adventure of going from sexual repression, bringing sexual activity into the light, into the open air, and people starting to know one another through sexuality. I thought it was really, really, really important. And as we were editing, we had some fantastic material from, our storytellers are so incredibly eloquent, and our stock footage is so fantastic, and our photographs are so wonderful. They're amazing period pieces. We have photographs of just incredible sexual activity going on all over the streets and nooks and crannies of New York and beaches. It's amazing stuff. That's what I wanted the film to be about. I really wanted it to be an open and frank discussion of sexuality.
This has been a conversation with filmmaker Joseph Lovett. Gay Sex in the 70s is in limited theatrical distribution, rolling out for the next few months in cities throughout the U.S. It will be released on DVD through Wolf Video in spring 2006. For more information on this and other queer films, visit prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Christopher Gall, Lucia Chappelle, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Curtis Crick, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Rita Gonzalez and to the late, great David Fratkin. The Village People performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Your help to keep this program on the air will still mean twice as much to us, but only until November 30th, 2005. Please log on to thiswayout.org for all the details. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KEOS College Station, Texas, Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.